This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. And a reminder that this is day four of the WRKF Fall Membership Drive. We'd like for you to contribute, and certainly we like it when you contribute this hour. It makes us feel like we're doing something that is worthwhile when you pledge whatever you can, no matter what you can. Any amount is well received. The number to call is 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753, or you can always go to WRKF.org. We begin with John Hechinger. He's the senior editor for Bloomberg News, two-time winner of the George Polk Award for reporting on education. His latest work is True Gentlemen. It's a book about the fraternity culture, which is certainly relevant based on what's happened in recent days here in Baton Rouge with the death of Maxwell Groover, an 18-year-old Phi Delta Theta pledge who apparently, according to reports, was drinking heavily and died after a night of binge drinking at the fraternity house. And the fraternity has been thrown off campus, at least for now, by the president of the university, King Alexander. In an op-ed piece that appeared in the New York Times 3 days ago, John wrote a piece that the headline reads, "Keep or Get the Keg Out of the Frat House." And he notes that fraternities are growing in popularity, but are in desperate need of reform. And once again, this is an issue that's quite personal to many in our audience. If you'd like to comment, we invite your participation. 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757. Elsewhere, the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, in your research, which of course came long before the recent development here in Louisiana, you received unusual access to one of the major fraternities in the United States. How did this happen?
Well, I had written a series of stories with a colleague about deaths at fraternities, and SAE had had more deaths than any other. And after the stories came out, the fraternity decided to take some action and to ban pledging, which is when a lot of hazing deaths occur. And when I suggested a book to the that I wanted to work on a book to the president, Brad Cohn, he thought that it would be important to let people know both the good and the bad about fraternity culture. And so he really welcomed me to meetings, to the annual leadership school that's held on a cruise, 700 of their members. So it really enabled me to, I hope, to get a much fuller picture of fraternity culture.
Well, there are so many, as people have noted over the last several days, there are many good things about fraternities, but there are some things that are cause for concern, and you have noted those. What's your biggest concern based on having an insider's view of this culture?
There's no question that the number one concern is alcohol. Alcohol from really the beginning of the fraternity movement in the 19th century has been a problem with fraternities. And it's been particularly a problem since the 1980s and the current rise of fraternities to becoming even more of a powerhouse on campuses. And fraternity men, the research shows, drink more than anyone else on campus. And I think fraternity national organizations know they need to combat this. They need to figure out a way to take measures that will reduce drinking, at least reduce drinking. And there have been some efforts that have made some difference. And that's number one.
You say banning pledging helped Sigma Alpha Epsilon. How so?
Well, they had a particularly brutal history of hazing, and pledging often sounds very, it sounds like it's a learning experience. But what tends to happen is you have a young person away from home for the first time. They're easily influenced. They start doing, maybe some chores, some driving, and then it kind of escalates until often it ends up with some kind of test involving drinking enormous amounts of alcohol. And that is where many of the deaths happen. And we don't know what happened at LSU, but that's likely what happened. And it's also definitely what happened at Penn State, where Tim Piazza died just in February. So the idea is if you eliminate pledging, because it's kind of a period where freshmen are at risk, they're kind of second-class citizens, then you would make fraternity safer. And it's been true for SAE. They had the most deaths of any fraternity for almost a decade, and they haven't had any since, and their insurance rates are lower. And, you know, they'll be the first to admit it's not perfect, but it seems like it made a big difference.
877-217-5757 is your number, and if you'd like to talk with John Hechinger, he'll be with us for a little while. He is the senior editor for Bloomberg News and has written a book about the fraternity culture, True Gentlemen, which was long in the works before the death of Maxwell Groover a few weeks ago at LSU. In an op-ed piece in the New York Times 3 days ago, John writes, an investigation into the death of the student who had been drinking at Louisiana State University's Phi Delta Theta house will most likely point to a familiar culprit, the toxic brew of alcohol and hazing. The Louisiana case is only the latest example in a horrifying but persistent trend. At Penn State, 14 Beta Theta Phi members will soon face a criminal trial because a pledge or new member died of traumatic brain injuries in February. They're accused of ordering him to drink until he could barely stand. So you're saying this is a nationwide issue. It's not just something that's significant in Louisiana or the South. It's happening everywhere.
Absolutely. You know, there's at least one hazing death a year on college campuses. Usually it's fraternities. At Bloomberg, we looked at almost a decade worth of data, and we saw about six or seven a year, and mostly because of alcohol and hazing. So it's absolutely a national problem. And until there's some kind of broad effort by fraternities and colleges to tackle it, it's just going to continue.
Well, a listener notes that it was 20 years ago, almost exactly, that Ben Wen, who was a Sigma Alpha Epsilon pledge at LSU, died after a night of binge drinking at the old Murphy's Bar. His blood alcohol level was 0.588. So at that level, death is almost a certainty, and he didn't make it. And it's hard to believe that a young man could get in that kind of a situation. But do they have enormous peer pressure when this hazing process is going on?
They do. It is difficult to say no. I mean, I spoke to a young man who was at Salisbury University in Maryland, and what seems to happen is, you know, you start out, it seems like this is an incredible opportunity. You have a great career network. You have access to a terrific social life, and it starts slowly and it escalates into what is often called Hell Week, which just goes back to, you know, almost forever in the fraternity movement. And once you've started doing some of these humiliating things, you feel like, well, you really want to be part of this group. You're away from home for the first time. And it just often leads to this. Even if it's often doesn't lead into death or hospitalizations or all kinds of injuries. And I think that young men away from home for the first time might not understand how dangerous alcohol can be in large amounts.
Is this a case where the university can do the policing, or does ultimately the fraternities have to do it themselves?
I think both have to do it. There needs to be adult advisors, preferably living in the house and taking their job very seriously. But the colleges really can't look the other way anymore. It's not a secret that there's a lot of drinking going on in the basements of fraternities all over the country. And, you know, colleges, they market fraternities as, you know, as a part of a vibrant social life on many campuses. They use it to attract students. They get donations from alumni, which they really appreciate. But they need to step up and say this isn't acceptable anymore.
It's been noted, John, by a few listeners in our conversations over the last few weeks that Greek members contribute to their universities, LSU included, at higher levels than the other student population. So the universities, they certainly don't want to lose those contributions.
No, they don't. And but it's interesting. I spoke to the former president of the University of Rhode Island, who was a fraternity man before becoming president, and he took on the party culture there, and he decided it was worth perhaps angering some of the alumni, and he told me that after doing it, some fraternity alumni said, you know what, I'm sorry that you had to kick my chapter off campus, but it needed to be done. So, you know, it's about protecting young men, and I think everyone in the end could be on the same page.
We're visiting with John Hechinger, and we will return with him. Your number is 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar is producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF, and it's day four of the fall membership drive. Your number to make a contribution, which would be much appreciated, is 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. Our number is 877-217-5757, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting with John Hechinger, senior editor for Bloomberg News, two-time winner of the George Polk Award for his reporting on education. His book is True Gentlemen, and it's about the fraternity culture. He had unusual access to one of the major fraternities in the United States, and his association with Sigma Alpha Epsilon led to some findings that some folks find alarming. John in New Roads writes that alcohol and hazing break down inhibitions to engage in sexual acts. Is that part of the experience that we're talking about here? It's not only a drinking issue, but perhaps other issues as well?
Oh, it's definitely other issues as well. The reason that alcohol is so important to address is that excessive drinking is often a contributor to sexual assaults. There's enormous research showing this. And if you create an environment where you have young women who often are away from home for the first time, who are delighted to be invited to a party where they don't know their alcohol tolerance, and they can easily get into trouble. They may not have friends who are going to protect them. And it's just one sociologist described it to me as it's a fraternity house is kind of it's a place where sexual assault becomes a predictable outcome. And so again, if fraternities can cut back on the drinking and the parties inside the frat houses, women will be safer.
Also, another listener notes that a couple of the fraternities, at least two at LSU, were accused of engaging in cruel activities to animals. We're talking about goats and sheep, and this is something that people would find probably alarming and perhaps unaware that something like this could be occurring on a college campus. But have you heard things to that effect?
Yes, I write in the book about a fraternity that was disciplined in part by a chapter got a goat and was advertising in terms of a party that people could feed beer to the goat and put it on social media. And one of the issues now is social media and cell phone videos. This kind of behavior becomes public much more often, and that's another. You know, threat to fraternities, but it's also a way to kind of expose some of this behavior. And, you know, fraternity guys have to realize that if they don't want the world to see what they're doing, they gotta stop doing it.
You note in your op-ed piece, John Hechinger, that even with all the bad behavior and bad press, that fraternities are more popular than ever. What is the lure to get young men to join fraternities?
Well, there was recently a really massive Gallup survey about this, and the results are really interesting. Members of Greek organizations, they report they have a better sense of well-being on campus, a bigger sense of community, more of a sense of purpose. And even afterwards, they have a greater attachment to their college, and often feel that they're better prepared for life and the relationships that they need than sort of the average student. And these are, you know, I talk to a lot of fraternity alumni, and you know, they tell me that it was important. Their best friends were in their fraternity. They were the best men at their wedding, and they expect them to be the pallbearers at their funeral. And you know, this is a very, you know, divided and atomized world, and these kinds of bonds are really important, and not to be minimized. And the question is whether they can be separated from the darker behavior.
Here's a note from Gloria asking if there is also an issue at some sororities of some of the same concerns that you have expressed here.
Not really. Sororities have different issues, but sororities operate in a way where they basically don't allow alcohol in sorority houses, which is part of the reason why if you go to a sorority house, you'll see that it looks a lot better than most fraternity houses, very well kept up. And they usually have an adult living there. So, and sororities, by and large, have not had the problem of, you know, deaths in their houses or anything like that. So in a way, it's kind of, it shows how fraternities could operate. Now, I should say that sorority women often go to fraternity parties, and the research shows that they're more likely to become sexual assaulted because they're going to fraternity parties. It's where the alcohol is. So, mm-hmm. but again, I think sororities do, you know, they do point the way forward.
Well, what do you say to those, John, who believe that any time you get a group of testosterone-laden men who are between 18 and 22 for the most part and get them together, you're going to have problems? And some have said in the last few weeks in defense of the fraternities that, hey, look at other parts of the campus, that things like this go on there as well.
Well, that is often the argument. And, yes, there's a lot of drinking on campus. Binge drinking is a huge problem. But decades of research show that fraternity men are the heaviest drinkers on campus. So if you want to do something about the culture of drinking on college campuses, fraternities are really the natural place to start. And the fraternity national leadership, you know, tells me that they want to do that. So that's the opportunity. You know, if they want to protect the lives of young men and not be sued for after sexual assaults, it's in their interest to change this culture.
That has to be a terrible call. It's an understatement, but I can only imagine the pain that is involved when a parent receives a call that his or her son has been killed as a result of binge drinking at a fraternity right after going to college. It has to be just devastating.
Definitely. I mean, it is so sad. Each case, the individual details are really difficult to grapple with. And, you know, you see the young men who died have had such promise. And I think that they look to the fraternity. Yes, maybe they looked to the fraternity for a place to have parties. But I do believe that they were also looking to have friends. And it's just, it's amazing to me that some of these traditions like pledging survive, and you know that so few fraternities have questioned it.
Well, John Hechinger, your book is important. It's True Gentlemen, and has received rave reviews from people of various walks of life, including Diane Ravitch, who's been on this show a few times. She's an education expert, as we know, and she says the book will show us that the culture of binge drinking, hazing, misogyny, racism, and brutality that John Hechinger brilliantly describes is gripping and powerful storytelling. Thank you for joining us, John. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Jim.
And hopefully we'll talk again soon. Appreciate it.
Hope so, too.
Coming next, we're going to visit with Barbara Radnofsky. Her book is A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment, and Barbara was slated to be with us a few days ago, but she kindly put it off because we were engaged in a conversation that went into overtime. And then later we'll hear from a gentleman who is in studio, Don Wynell. He went on an amazing adventure over the last few years. Bicycling the Oregon Trail is his book. And a reminder that we would like for you to contribute to WRKF. We only do this a couple of times a year, so this is your opportunity in the fall to make a contribution. If you haven't done so this year, please do so right now. We'd love to hear from you. If you're a first-time contributor, even better. And if you need to renew or would like to make an additional contribution, that's great, too. WRKF has been an oasis of civility on your dial at 89.3 since January 18th, 1980, almost 38 years. And the only way it'll continue to be that is if you contribute. 855-893-9753, 855-893-9753. Now we break for the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Our guest is Barbara Radnofsky. She is a Democratic politician from the great state of Texas and the first woman to have won the Democratic nomination for a U.S. Senate seat in the Lone Star State. Her book is A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment. And hello, Barbara Radnofsky. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you very much, Jim. Real honor to be with you.
Well, tell us about perhaps some of the misconceptions we have about impeachment.
I think the most interesting one is one that I had before I started researching. I thought that a high crime and misdemeanor, the criteria for impeachment, I thought it might involve a crime or a misdemeanor, and it doesn't. It's a phrase that has nothing to do with crimes and misdemeanors. It's an ancient British phrase, and it has an entirely different meaning as adapted by our founding fathers.
Well, we've had an impeachment in modern time. 19 years ago, President Clinton was impeached. Was that the classic case, or was that an unusual one as far as a president being impeached by the House and then not being convicted by the Senate?
It would be a classic case, in my opinion. The 19 cases in U.S. history each teach a lesson, and the Clinton impeachment is completely consistent with the lessons of the other 18. And by the way, there were ones after Clinton as well. But the presidential impeachment of Clinton is particularly helpful because it hits on the key criteria for high crimes and misdemeanors. High crimes and misdemeanors, in order to have a conviction in the Senate, requires substantial harm to society. The mainstay ground and the true meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors, according to the founding fathers, was that it be an act or omission, doesn't even require intent, but an act or omission or maladministration that causes harm to society, because it's not a criminal proceeding. It's an entirely different thing, and it's not for crimes. Now, if there have been many people accused and proven to have committed a crime, and that became a basis for impeachment, but there are many crimes that do not warrant impeachment, and there are others where even though the person has been convicted of a crime, they can be acquitted in impeachment. That is entirely possible. And on the other hand, when people have been acquitted of a crime, we know in history, and this is an example from U.S. impeachment, they were actually convicted in impeachment because they committed perjury in the underlying crime, and that was a federal judge.
The guest is Barbara Radnofsky. Her book is A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment, and it is an important book because, as we know, in modern time, less than 20 years ago, we had a president who was impeached. There was a massive investigation led by Ken Starr. The U.S. House ultimately voted in favor of two of the four articles, and then the Senate could not get a majority on either of them, and President Clinton survived an impeachment attempt. There are those who are saying that this special counsel, Robert Mueller, is on the brink of perhaps offering the same kind of evidence to Congress that Ken Starr did. Of course, a different kind of investigation. But nonetheless, is this relevant to the discussion about our current president?
Investigation of a crime is certainly relevant. But I must emphasize that a crime is not required for impeachment. And the proof of a crime, the fact that someone has been convicted of a crime, does not in and of itself prove impeachability. It is an entirely separate process. Double jeopardy does not apply, and therefore the lesson from the Clinton impeachment was that perjury or lying in the eyes of the House could be an impeachable offense during this prosecutorial phase. Impeachment itself in the House is considered by Alexander Hamilton and the Founding Fathers to be the accusation stage, very much like a prosecutor bringing charges. Well, the Senate tries the case. Even though in president's cases, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is the presiding officer, he's just a figurehead. The Senate has the sole power to try the case as judge and jury, just as the House has the sole power to impeach. We know from Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion in a case called Nixon v. U.S., Judge Walter Nixon v. the U.S., that that's not in the purview of the courts, of the Supreme Court. It is solely within the power of the House to impeach and the Senate to convict. And what the main thing I hope people gain out of this rather simple, straightforward book is that it's about harm to society, not proving intent or a crime.
It's a high bar, though, when it takes two-thirds of the members of the Senate to convict. So with the political process as we know it today, partisan as it is it nearly impossible to impeach a president, to convict a president who's been impeached by the House?
Well, that's a very good question, and one that if you talked to somebody like me, you'd merely get an opinion. My heart tells me that the way Congress has worked, even in the most strident of times, right after the Civil War during the Andrew Johnson impeachment, the House and the Senate acted on their best behavior in the Senate, and as far as the House, they accused. And to many people, the House did their job. But what the Senate did was its deliberative process. And in that case, you had, they called them Republican recusants back at the time of Johnson. They went over to the Democrat side and they voted. Now, in that case, they felt that the opposition party president should not be convicted. These are Republicans voting against their own party to do what they felt was the right thing during the time of Johnson. And you will see that repeatedly, even earlier in the very first impeachment conviction in U.S. history. It was a very difficult decision to make because it was a senile judge. Senile. Mm-hmm. Could not have intent. And people felt sorry for him.
Well, Richard Nixon's...
They got together and convicted him.
Richard Nixon's resignation was prompted by the threat of impeachment and conviction in the Senate. And based on what we know, Barbara, it appears that President Nixon would have faced a very difficult time making his case to stay in office.
I think that's a very important point. And we spoke earlier of Chief Justice Rehnquist. Rehnquist, who was an expert on impeachment and wrote a fine book about it, did the unusual step as a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice, the Chief Justice, of complimenting what happened during the Nixon impeachment process, complimented its bipartisanship. And we have tremendously good law as a result of that bipartisan House Judiciary Committee. Keep in mind, they voted on the articles of impeachment. And so you had a House committee vote, and it was clear, I think, to Nixon that he was fixing to be impeached.
Now, you have studied this earnestly, and based on your scrutiny of the Constitution, do you think that this is a good system we have?
I love this system. I didn't love it until I started researching it. This is the greatest system the world has ever known, and I say that as a student, of course, but as a true lover of the Constitution. And the checks and balances we have, and the genius of the Founding Fathers, as I've studied how they debated in the Federalist Papers, this is a calm, orderly, quote, regular, end quote, process of impeachment. That's how the Founding Fathers viewed it. They voted this kind of process and viewed it as a regular process that would otherwise be, and I'm quoting from the Founding Fathers, irregularly inflicted by tumults and insurrection. And so I get much comfort the fact that we have a regular process that does not have the uncertainties and crisis and chaos associated with, well, look at some of the things that are happening, indictment and possible claims of possible indictment and criminal conviction of a sitting U.S. president. Highly controversial. Going to be involved in the courts for some time. Very debatable. Suing the president for abuse of his pardon power. Highly controversial and will be in the courts for some time. Suing the president over emoluments. Very, very debatable on issues of standing and yet bringing up very important issues. No constitutional crisis with impeachment. It is a regularized process developed over hundreds of years and streamlined in the 1980s thanks to a great degree, some judicial impeachments and improvements in the Clinton process. So we can thank the Clinton process for what Lindsey Graham said after it was over, lifting a cloud from the presidency. It has a cleansing purpose either way, regardless of result. Mm-hmm. Yes, I love this process.
Well, when Mr. Mueller releases his findings, do you think that this conversation will gain some momentum as far as the process of impeachment?
Well, I guess it depends on what Mueller finds. If we're to believe what the leaks tell us, there may be significant interest in both parties. I would like to see Mueller have plenty of time to do his work. I do not think that the Mueller issues, I must pluralize, are the sole ones that are on people's minds, however, and I don't think they're solely on the House's mind, although you would probably point out to me that the first impeachment resolution or that has been offered and then gone to committee involved the firing of Mr. Comey. I do think this is going to be taken very seriously by the House, along with some other complaints that are being made, including the pardon process.
The book is A Citizen's Guide to Impeachment from Barbara Radnofsky, and we thank you for joining us, and certainly it is an important book. We appreciate your time today. And a reminder that this is day 4 of your fall membership drive for WRKF, and you hear interviews on public radio that may stick with you, listening intently until they're over, those driveway moments, and sometimes we think about them for hours, maybe even days. The best journalism on public radio can be described as great storytelling with meticulous fact-checking. It's reporting that informs us, engages us, challenges us, even calls us to action. Public radio provides outstanding journalism every day, and it survives because listeners who value the product support the station, and this station has been around for almost 38 years because of listeners like you. 877-217-5757 is our number, and the number to call for the contributions is 855-893-9753. If you contribute $10 or $20 a month, it'll be added to the contributions of others to keep the stories coming right here on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and a reminder that this is day 4 of the fall membership drive, and this is the only national public radio outlet for several miles, and I know people listen to WRKF because of its strong signal and many other places around Louisiana, and particularly in South Louisiana, and actually online all over the country. WRKF presents the best in NPR programming, and the reporters, they live in D.C., in Los Angeles, New York, Miami, Boston, Dallas. You hear them often, but they aren't the only journalists we hear on the air. Each year, hundreds of reporters who work at NPR member stations like WRKF file reports that cover events such as natural disasters, protests, elections. We've got one of those coming October 14th. And local reports bring a unique perspective to nationally based programming. And your contributions keep the national and local flavor going on WRKF. 855-893-9753. That's 855-893-9753. Or 24 hours a day, you can go to WRKF.org. A note about our first guest, John Hechinger from Lisa LeBlanc. She says, sounds like your speaker blames young women for being assaulted because of their low tolerance to alcohol. The blame is on the person or persons committing the crime. And I don't think anyone would disagree with you, Lisa. Thank you for calling and sending us a message. And we're joined now in studio by Don Wynell. He works for the Department of Environmental Quality, has for the last 26 years, native of Shreveport, graduate of one of the great athletic entities and a pretty good school, too, Shreveport Woodlawn, which produced Terry Bradshaw, Joe Ferguson, and Robert Parrish. The book is Bicycling the Oregon Trail, so Don is a different kind of athlete, and bicyclists are athletes. I think we would agree with that, Don.
Well, thank you for inviting me here, Jim. With any hobby or endeavor, there's various levels of athletic skill, and I would consider myself a hobbyist rather than a full athlete. It's speed is not as important as just sticking with it in this particular endeavor.
In your case, you took 5 years to complete this journey. You have a day job, so you couldn't take off a whole lot of time, but how long did it take in full?
In terms of riding, I believe it was 59 days of actual riding during that time, which is still quite a bit faster than the original pioneers did it.
Yeah, and then you got to see a lot of our country, some states that you get to know a lot better when you're on a bicycle.
Yes, when you're traveling in a vehicle, you're insulated from the weather and from just the sounds and the smells and the people that you're passing along the way.
What were some of the most memorable places?
I'd say South Pass, Wyoming, because that is one of the points on the Oregon Trail where it crosses the Continental Divide. But the Oregon Trail is not so much a single trail, but it's a rope that is frayed on both ends. People started at different locations. Mm-hmm. They traveled the trail, and they ended at different locations. But just about every wagon, every person, every animal that traveled the Oregon Trail crossed at South Pass. So when I'm camping there, I was very cognizant of the fact that 500,000 people camped in the same location 170 years ago.
Wow. Some beautiful places.
Oh, some very stark and isolated places, too.
And some places tougher to navigate than others on a bicycle.
Yes, there was a lot of walking involved, but keep in mind that the vast majority of the original travelers walked. What you see on TV of people riding in covered wagons seldom happened. Anybody that was above the age of 3 or 4 walked.
The guest is Don Wynell. His book is Bicycling the Oregon Trail. 175 Oregon Trail landmarks are included, and the book is more than a travel guide. It's kind of like Travels with Charlie with John Steinbeck. It was quite an experience for you. When you go on an adventure like this, what kind of – you're limited because you can't have a whole lot of stuff with you, but you got to have some necessities. What do you bring with you?
Brought a tent, a sleeping bag, lots of water because, you can live a few days without food if you have to, but out there in the high desert of Wyoming or Idaho, water is very critical. Being a historian, I knew where some of the traditional water points were, so that was always in the back of my mind, but water was probably the most important thing to carry with you.
Did you have others riding with you?
No, it was completely solo.
You're doing it all by yourself?
Yes, there were several points where I'd go 2 or 3 days without even seeing another person.
Really?
Yes.
So you're living off water?
Well, no, I mean, peanut butter and tortillas, that's kind of the traditional last meal of resort or last resort for a hungry bicyclist. But, instant grits, instant oatmeal, breakfast bars.
Would you do it again?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. Got another trip planned next summer.
But I'm impressed that you did this by yourself. Not many people would do that, but bicycling in some ways is a solitary process. Do you ever have any close calls?
No. There was one point in Nebraska. I was camping in a little town park, and in the middle of the night, there was a vehicle that just kept circling and circling. And, of course, you start thinking of all the possibilities. But in reality, no, there wasn't any close calls.
How many states are involved in this adventure?
Let's see, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Wyoming, Idaho, and Oregon. If you were going all the way to Oregon, but the original pioneers, they didn't follow the Oregon Trail just to Oregon. A lot of them went to Utah, and a lot of them, probably the majority of them, actually veered off and went to California for the gold fields.
This must give you an appreciation for what they did.
Tremendously. The hardships that I may have faced were nothing compared to these folks. And a lot of them were families. And this was a 5 or 6 month adventure for them.
And how long would you generally ride per day, Don?
It depended on the terrain and the weather. My planning distance was 40 to 50 miles a day. There were some days I was lucky to get 12 miles, but there were other days where, you know, 60 or so would be okay.
I'm sure you had some aches and pains.
After the first couple of days, a lot of that went to the wayside. The first day or two, you know, it's just a matter of getting back on the bike again. And you're so excited about the adventure that you don't drink as much water as perhaps you should. But once you get into it for another summer, then, you know, not so much.
What kind of bicycle?
It is a touring bike, which most people aren't familiar with. It has mountain bike gearing, so it's lower geared than a typical road bike or race bike. But it doesn't have the suspension, no front or rear suspension like a mountain bike. It's made to handle weight, and it's made to be to withstand, you know, the rough terrain, and it's made to be fixed more simply. You know, it's no complex.
Did you have any issues where you had to repair it?
No, as a matter of fact, I only had one flat tire the entire time.
Really?
So, okay.
Well, you, like most bicycles, you're not a huge man, but still, you rode that a lot of miles. I suspect you lost a little weight on the trail.
I would lose maybe about 10 pounds every year, but you know, on a bicycle, on something like this, you're not as isolated from towns along the way as maybe if you were hiking the Appalachian Trail or something. So usually one meal a day, I'd find myself in a town where I could eat something at a cafe or whatever.
Did you ever stay in a hotel, or was this?
Oh, yes. It all depended on what was available. Most of the time was camping, and there were a few hotels and a couple bed and breakfasts along the way.
Well, Don saw the same sights that wagon-trained Iris described and experienced 170 years ago. Bet you had to have a good pair of shoes.
Oh, just walking shoes, you know. I didn't wear the clip-in bicycle shoes that a lot of riders wear. For one thing, it would require me to carry more than one pair of shoes with me, and half of the adventure was on foot exploring also.
Well, the book has received some nice plaudits, and it is available where?
Oh, Amazon, of course. Barnes & Noble had a few copies here in town. I'm not sure if they still have any on the shelf.
Bicycling the Oregon Trail, and one reviewer says, I'm in awe of Don's dedication to tackle this journey and cover it on a bicycle. His stories of visiting the iconic places on the Oregon Trail are clear and entertaining, and you did it all by yourself, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Don Wynell. And please call, if you have not done so, 855-893-9753 to make your contribution, 855-893-9753. We'll be back Monday, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.